Cricklewood, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent and you were old and grey.
Cor Corran, the columns of Alan Corran. Part 5, One is One and All Alone.
While I have always brandished healthy scepticism in the face of such jolly legends as the one which has it that wee Jimmy Watt saw his mam's kettle rattling and immediately began working out how to get it to pull the 8:14 from Leeds to Euston, I nevertheless accept that many a scientific discovery is born of happy accident. Until Wednesday, however, I had never been able to test this personally. Despite my having spent 19,764 days wandering the planet, each of them had gone by without my fortuitously stumbling against something which, after I'd tinkered with it a bit, would leave that planet a better place. But on Wednesday, the search for a housewarming present led me to a Notting Hill junk shop, where, having judged the options of a clockwork parrot that shrieked, "Guten Morgen!" and a vase which let you shove flowers where Gladstone's brains ought to be, I plumped for a great exhibition glass paperweight the size of a tennis ball containing Queen Victoria, Prince Albert, and a couple of dogs, who, having set off for a stroll on a fine clear morning, could have their day ruined by anyone who cared to shake their premises, covering its inhabitants with snow. Set on a yellowed ivory base, it was patently worth every penny to anyone born yesterday, so I forked out and drove it home. It was only after I had unwrapped it that I noticed that the newspaper it had been swaddled in was slightly moist. I ran a finger over the paperweight and found that this was slightly moist, too. That it had suffered a minor leak, possibly as the result of rolling around in my glove compartment, was obvious, as soon as I allowed the whirling storm to settle. Everything was covered in snow, except the consort's stovepipe hat, which was above the level of the fluid. The tableau had thus taken on a far more sombre cast than hitherto, suggesting that the luckless royals had been cheerfully walking their dogs on, say, some frozen pond, when the ice had suddenly given way beneath them. Since, clearly, you could not warm a house with so broken down a gift, I turned the paperweight this way and that, finally working out, from the continued seepage, that the fluid was emerging between the glass ball and the ivory base, since when I tightened this latter, the leaking stopped. Obviously, all that was required was for me to unscrew it completely, refill the ball with water, and screw it up again. After a minute or so, I had an unscrewed base, an empty crystal ball, an unpronounceable hemisphere of green glass grass, with one royal and one dog attached to it, a little pile of white flakes, and, separately, another royal and another dog. Quite why Queen Victoria and one of her dogs should have detached themselves from the green glass grass, I didn't know, nor why Queen Victoria, when I picked her up to try to find out, left her little head between my thumb and forefinger. Upon closer examination, however, I discovered that all these discrete components had originally been held in place by tiny pegs. So it was with great relief that I carefully reassembled the whole, put everything back in the ball, filled it with water, and screwed the base on again, very tightly. It was perfect. Until, that is, I shook it. When I did that, the snow eddied up, which it was supposed to do, but so did Queen Victoria's head, which wasn't. After a bit, Her Majesty's head came down again, but as it did so, it passed her dog, going up. Since I do not understand, you may be surprised to hear, hydrodynamics, I cannot tell you why, when I shook it again, Prince Albert now shot upwards through the falling snow, thankfully missing his wife's head coming down, but colliding with her descending dog. It was horrible. It was hilarious. What did I have? I had an animated Chagall. But I also had, unquestionably, an invention. By happy accident, I had produced an original artifact. And now that I have also detached Prince Albert's head and the other dog, I have a 3D narrative kaleidoscope of infinite themes. Each time I shake it, a different tale of Grand Guignol appears. This is nothing less than a tiny Victorian telly. Catch me giving this away. I intend to stay here playing with it until they come round to put my blue plaque up.
Vaulting ambition, buying golden opinions, infirm of purpose.
Macbeth does murder sleep, no question. I have lain awake since midnight, thinking of nothing else, and it is now 4:30. And yes, since you ask, I did hear the owl scream and the crickets cry. Either that, or it was the cat next door sorting a mouse out, and the people across the road winding their marriage up yet again. It isn't easy to put your finger on peripheral stuff when you're struggling to direct every knackered brain cell towards a major career move. So the prospectus from Macbeth PLC arrived yesterday morning, from Stratford-upon-Avon. Express. Recorded delivery. Why did it do all this? It did all this because I had snipped and posted a coupon from the Times, offering me the opportunity to become involved in making the film for which Macbeth PLC had been set up by its parent company, Cromwell Productions Limited. Now, since the conjunction of opportunity and involved is invariably a synonym for folding money, and almost invariably also a synonym for plughole, you may well wonder why so fly a fellow as I should not have left his scissors lying safely on the shelf beside his barge pole and turned his thoughts to better things. But that is only because you did not read the coupon. True, it invited subscriptions of not less than £500 in the project, but what it offered in return was not just a share in any net profit of the film, repayment of capital with interest, and a ticket for the world premiere, all of which one would expect. It also offered what one would never expect in a million years, viz., the right to appear as an extra in the film and a listing in the credits. A snip or what? So I snipped. And now the glossy prospectus lies glimmering beside my bed, open at the application form which dangles the stardom requiring only my filling in of my chosen amount and writing the cheque for same. But for how much? Put another way, stardom as what? A tree, perhaps. A basic 500 quid ought to get me the part of a nice big fir, waddling from Burnham Wood to Dunsinane by virtue, you will recall, of the soldier concealed inside it. Not too much acting demanded there. You just wave your twigs about a bit, possibly do the odd wind whistle or chirrup. I could do that. I can see the reviews now. Loath as I am to single out anyone from the stunning arboreal ensemble, if Alan Corran's brilliant conifer does not receive, at the very least, a nomination for Best Supporting Tree, nor, for another tactical grand say, is it impossible that Macbeth PLC would be averse to the minor textual change of Till Cricklewood removed to Dunsinane, bringing a special joy to countless local tradesmen, many with bills outstanding, though my cheques, of course, are in the post. Invest a bit more, mind, and I could doubtless get my entire face on screen, not just one eye in a knothole. A couple of thousand for an attendant, perhaps, three for a lord, while five should almost certainly entitle me to a further textual tweak and very nearly a speaking role. Duncan. What bloody man is that? Not him, the other one. Camera pans from bleeding corporal to sergeant. Then again, there's the third murderous slot. It has baffled critics since footnotes began. Just the two come on in Act 3, Scene 1, so where is the missing hitman? I see him up in the gallery, spotlit, after the rest exeunt, call it Scene 1A, doing an engaging bit of business, honing his dagger, perhaps, twirling his moustache, rolling an eye, licking a lip, cackling, all that. And if, furthermore, he suddenly whipped off his moustache to reveal the bloody corporal a split second before the spotlight snapped off, we could be looking at a brand new subtext more than likely to put deconstructionism right back on its feet. Especially if he reappears in Act 5 as a tree. They could cost a bob or two, though, three different roles. That is why I lie here at now 5:30, fraught with indecision. A bit like Hamlet, really. Particularly if anyone from Hamlet PLC is listening to this.
I need assistance, and if I don't get it, I may sulk and suck my thumb.
I lay in bed this morning trying to work out what I needed. And by the time I got up at 9:30, I had worked out exactly what I needed. I needed somebody to get me up before 9:30. Most mornings I do not even lie there working things out. I just lie there. Every morning Mr. and Mrs. Corran wake up at 7:15. One of them goes off to work at 8, and the other one just lies there, because when he goes off to work, he goes off to it in the loft. And since he doesn't have to go at any particular time, he just lies there. After a couple of hours he plods downstairs and wonders whether to make himself a cooked breakfast. He would like a cooked breakfast, it would do him good, it would set him up for the day, it would send him bounding into the loft. But he cannot be bothered to cook it. So he stares out of the window for an hour, wondering whether to go for a walk round the park instead. It would do him good. It would set him up for the day. It would send him bounding into the loft. But he lives a mile from the park. If he walked to it, he would not have the energy left to walk round it. He would have to drive to it. But if he drove to it, he would have to leave his car outside it. And when he got back, he would find a ticket under his wiper, and a clamp on his wheel, and a gap where his radio used to be. But if he had someone to get him out of bed at 8:30, the someone could not only make him a cooked breakfast, porridge, boiled eggs, soldiers, but also drive him to the park, wait, and after his walk, tell him it was now time to be a good boy, and go to the loft, and get on with his work. Yes, that is what I finally worked out this morning. I need a nanny. A nanny is the only cure, not merely for the indolence of the solitary hack, but for the habits, even worse than indolence, which indolence generates. Like smoking too much. I cannot cut down alone, I need someone to cry, take that filthy thing out of your mouth. Like drinking too much, I cannot cut down alone, I need someone with the sideboard key in her pinny, and a tablespoon in her hand, who, once a day, would poke a small Glenlivet into my mouth. Unless, that is, she had caught me watching television too much. I cannot cut down on television alone. I have a set in the loft. I watch Neighbours. I watch Countdown. I watch Sesame Street. I need someone to cry, just half an hour a day, my little man, or it's no whiskey for you. Also, time for your 40 winks. I need someone to cry that too. Most afternoons I rack up 500 winks, minimum. Cheek on the desk, knuckles on the floor, especially after four fingers of scotch and a large blue Peter. But I cannot cut down alone. I need someone to bound into the loft, preferably with a glass of Tizer and a couple of hobnobs, and shake me, and tell me to sit up straight, because it is time to get back to work. And I would not complain about that work. I would not swear, or kick the computer, or decide to chuck it all in and retrain as a rag and bone man, because if I did, Nanny would wash my mouth out with Lifebuoy, and make me stand in the corner until it was time for my bath. I really need someone at bath time. I need someone to bath me, and make me all nice before Mrs. Corran gets home. If I bath myself, the odds are that when Mrs. Corran gets home, she will find me, thanks to the empty glass on the floor, having 500 winks in it, prune-shriveled, surrounded by bobbing dog-ends, chilled to the touch, and thus as far from all nice as it is possible to get. How much more pleasing for Mrs. Corran to turn her key in the lock and hear the cry, "He's all ready, madam," and see me tripping down the stairs, ears spotless, hair brushed, teeth flossed, and because I have been such a good boy, allowed to play with her until it was time to go to bed. Or even vice versa. Leaving only the matter of catching up on my reading. I do not do enough. It is tricky holding a big book when you are also holding a big glass and a big cigar. Two pages and I throw in the towel. What joy to be tucked in by a qualified tucker, who would then lilt a chapter or two of Rushdie until my lids drooped nodwards. Having to knock off a preliminary vesper is a small price to pay. God bless Nanny. I know that's right. Time to put an ad in the Lady.
Crickle Ward, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.
Cor Corran was written and read by Alan Corran, and produced by Alad Evans.
For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.